Welcome to the Week Ahead in Russia, RFURL's Monday podcast about significant developments and upcoming events in Moscow and beyond. I'm Steve Gutterman, and my guest this week is Sam Green, a professor at the Russia Institute at King's College London, director of Democratic Resilience at the Center for European Policy Analysis, or CEPA, and co-author of the book Putin versus the People. Sam, thank you very much for joining me this week. It's great to have you on the podcast again. I think the last time was back in September.
Thank you very much for having me back, Steve.
All right. It's great to have you back. One thing I'll just say, I read your Substack newsletter or blog this weekend, and the introduction was quite, I don't know, it just made me feel just about how it's been a year since the invasion, and, you know, every day, every hour, you know, Ukrainians don't know, you know, what's going to happen in the next hour. They can't count on essentially being alive. That really struck me, because sometimes I think we and I forget, or not forget, but the war kind of becomes something that is happening, and you need to stop sometimes and think about, you know, how horrible it really is and how unnecessary. So thanks for that. Okay, I'll go on now. Last Friday, February 24th, marked 1 year since Russia launched its large-scale invasion of Ukraine, massively escalating what had been a smaller conflict in the Donbass in eastern Ukraine that began in 2014. I will talk about this one-year mark and what may be in store in the coming year. But first, I want to ask about Russian President Vladimir Putin's address to the nation, to Russia, that came earlier last week on February 21st. He gave the speech one day after U.S. President Joe Biden traveled to Kiev, and 1 year after a particularly dark address by Putin that made many who doubted Russia would invade change their minds. At the time, you wrote that you had never seen a Putin speech quite like it, and that Putin was, quote, laying the groundwork for the wholesale occupation of Ukraine, unquote. Now, if that was the plan, as we know, it failed dramatically. Russian forces failed to take Kiev, and in fact, since the invasion, they've only taken one regional capital, Kherson, which they relinquished in November. So Ukraine has taken that back. Now, 1 year after the invasion, the end of the war does not seem to be in sight. And you know, it's been said that in many countries, a leader whose military campaign suffered as many failures as Putin's invasion of Ukraine has would soon be out of office. But Putin obviously is still in office, and he's still delivering speeches. Sam, what did you think of this one, the speech that he made on February 21st?
Well, you know, I'm glad that you brought up the speech from a year ago, although it's an unpleasant speech to remember, because I think the contrast is instructive. Putin does continue to use a lot of the same rhetoric, but he, I think a couple of things are missing. One thing that's missing is just the emotion of it, the fire and brimstone of it. Right? It was very much present a year ago, and which has been toned down now, and maybe it's simply difficult to keep up that level of sort of emotional fire. And certainly, I think that there's very little sense in the Russian public that anybody is up for that level of emotional sort of engagement, or at least that very many people are up for that. It's a difficult thing to maintain for a long period of time. You know, along with that, what's missing in the second speech is the clarity, right? You know, Putin was very clear in his first speeches ahead of this war, right? That, you know, that his goals were maximalist, right? That his goals were taking over the entirety of the country, creating regime change, and if not fully incorporating Ukraine formally into Russia, then at least, you know, putting it in a situation much like that of Belarus or even worse, right? In which any government in Kyiv would be essentially a puppet of Moscow. Now, I'm certain that Putin would be very happy to achieve those aims if he still could, right? But as you said, it became very clear to the rest of us, if it wasn't already clear, and certainly clear to Putin within the first couple of weeks of the war, that that wasn't going to happen that way, or at least it wasn't going to happen in any reasonable time frame, if it was ever going to happen at all. And so we've seen him spend the ensuing year building and maintaining a degree of rhetorical sort of fluidity and room for maneuver, right? So that he, can portray just about anything as a success. That speaks to a certain extent to your question about, you know, what, why, given the amount of failure that he has achieved, so to speak, right, why he hasn't faced consequences. It's because he's allowed himself, and certainly with a pliant media and a pliant political establishment, to, make anything short of, catastrophic defeat look like a success. And I think we saw that very clearly in this speech. He did not clarify his aims. He did not clarify his threats. He did not set out a pathway towards escalation or towards any particular war aims. We've seen, I think, yes, a Putin that is very committed to war as such, but it doesn't seem to care quite as much, or at least doesn't seem to speak quite as much about exactly what that war is meant to achieve as long as he remains in power.
Yeah, absolutely. Great points about what he said and especially didn't say in the speech. One of my colleagues wrote an analysis about it, which essentially said he's trying to normalize war or normalize the war, for Russians, getting them used to the idea that war is normal. Soldiers are going to get 2 weeks vacation twice a year, things like that. But he did not mention, he really didn't mention aims. He spoke about, benefits for the families of veterans and soldiers who've been killed, but he really didn't speak at all in any detail about what's happening in Ukraine. And he didn't say what it means to win. And he also didn't even, as far as I remember, he didn't promise that Russia would win, which he's done in the past. And of course, they are trying to frame this as a war, essentially a defensive war against NATO and the U.S. now, which he did again try to frame it that way. But he really didn't mention, as you said, he didn't mention any aims. Again, it does leave room, I guess, for him to claim victory under almost any circumstances, but also leaves little clarity about what may happen. So thanks for those comments. I'd like to talk about the war more broadly. So it's now been over a year since the Russian invasion. And Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is vowing to recapture all territory seized by Russia, including Crimea, which was seized in 2014. Since then, in September, Putin and Russia claimed that four other regions of Ukraine, are actually Russian. Really no grounds for that claim, aside from a referendum or so-called referendum that was widely dismissed as a sham. Now, Biden and the West, Biden traveled to Kyiv, was there one day before Putin's speech. Biden and the West are promising to support Ukraine for as long as it takes, without, I believe, saying exactly what that means, what is as long as it takes. And Putin has been signaling, including in this speech, that Russia is in it for the long haul. So, Sam, I'm not going to ask you what you think is going to happen in the war in the coming year, but what I will ask is what you'll be watching for, what kind of developments could have a substantial effect on the course of the war, or whether that would mean on the battlefield or in diplomacy in terms of aid and support, or inside Russia or Ukraine, or in the West for that matter.
Well, thank you for not asking me to predict the future. Something I don't enjoy doing. But look, I mean, there's a lot of things to look for, right? Things that we think can be important. The battlefield, certainly, as you mentioned, is one of them, although I'm not a military analyst. And so I tend to look at what the smart people, the people we all read and listen to, right? We'll say about that. Some of that, I suppose, is fairly obvious. If there's a collapse, if there's the lines on either side, if there's major progress made, we don't seem to be seeing that, but we've been surprised in the past. And I think we need to retain the capacity to at least imagine being surprised in the future. But I tend to think that as important as the battlefield is, the war is going to be won or lost in the minds of people making the decisions, right? And that's different in different countries. So you mentioned, you know, Zelensky has, again, in sharp contrast to Putin, but also, frankly, in contrast to Biden and most Western leaders, has been very clear about exactly what victory means. It means the full and incontrovertible restoration of Ukrainian sovereignty and territorial integrity. Zelensky is a politician like any other, whether in a democracy like Ukraine or in an autocracy like Russia, you know, who does have to pay some attention to what people on the ground think, to what constituents think, obviously, in a much more direct way in Ukraine than in Russia. But the fact that he is so clear about what he's trying to achieve and what Ukraine is trying to achieve is a reflection of the kind of relationship that he has with the Ukrainian people, right? So he draws his power and he draws his war aims from the Ukrainian people, right? He is seeking all of that, you know, complete victory because that is where the Ukrainian people are at the moment. Is it possible that the Ukrainian people at some point will shift? Yes, right? I don't see any indication that that's shifting. But it would be foolish to rule out the possibility that Ukrainians at some point, could say, actually, we need to stop fighting or we need to draw some lines. That's the sovereign and democratic right of the Ukrainian people to decide, right? So one thing to, continue to monitor is Ukrainian public opinion and how that's reflected in Zelensky's, policies. Another thing, to monitor is, whether or not the Western position begins to harden and solidify in reflecting that clarity that we're seeing from Kyiv. You know, you mentioned my Substack, and thank you for the plug. But my core argument in that, right, was really that it's wonderful to say that we will be in it for as long as it takes, but we should make sure that it doesn't take any longer than it has to. This is happening at a tremendous cost for Ukraine and Ukrainians, right? But there's also kind of there is, I think, a warfighting aspect to that commitment that hasn't really come through from the West. At the end of the day, we've provided just about every weapon system that Ukraine has asked for late. Too late in some cases. But the one thing that we really haven't provided, right, has been that sense of a commitment to Ukrainian victory on Ukrainian terms and to doing that as quickly as possible. And that's important because it can begin to shift, I think, the third thing that we should be paying attention to, which is Putin's own calculations, right? Putin, as you said, is setting this up as kind of a forever war, which, you know, suits his purposes as president. As we've seen, he's been able to a degree to normalize this for the Russian population, to convince people that this is something that they can bear for a long time to come, and that does, you know, really keep him central and sustainable in Russian politics. But that's predicated on the idea that time is on his side, right, and that he can control through the amount of effort that he imposes on the war, through the amount of men that he sends to the front, through the amount of material that he's able to raise, that more or less he controls the pace of fighting. He can speed it up or he can slow it down. If we were to make it clear that, in fact, we're going to empower Ukraine not just to persist, but to push the pace of the war, and to alter that calculation, then I think we could see Putin eventually decide that, in fact, there is less to be gained through fighting this war than he has allowed himself to imagine thus far. So those are the three things I would look for. I would look for, again, sort of the dynamics in Ukrainian public opinion. I would look for the clarity of commitment from the West, and I would look for Putin's calculations in response to those two things.
Thanks very much, Sam. That's very helpful, I think, for thinking about this. Just to follow up, one thing you mentioned, I mean, I would say, I guess Putin, you know, he mentioned one thing he didn't say much in the speech really at all on February 21st. He said very little that was meaningful, or would make one kind of think, oh, this is what he's going to do, or this is, but one thing he did mention, the Russian, elections, the presidential election coming up in March 2024, you know, I would assume that he's not going to, you know, short of an actual, you know, a big victory, which doesn't, you know, certainly doesn't seem probable at all for Russia in that time period. You know, I would assume that he's going to continue to kind of push the war and make it keep happening, at least through that time. But one thing I would ask, you mentioned at the beginning of your response, we should be, or I think you did, that we should be ready, at least for unexpected developments in terms of, you know, one lesson is lots of people predicted, failed to predict what would happen, whether Russia would invade, and then, you know, many people, as we know, analysts and others believed that Russia would pretty much achieve its goals quickly. And that didn't happen, as we discussed. And the idea that we didn't know what was going to happen last year, and now we still don't know what could happen. So I guess a follow-up question is both in terms of the battlefield and the diplomacy and support for Ukraine and Putin's calculations, you know, all the things you mentioned. Do you think there is sort of a chance that any or all of those things could kind of shift in the coming year or so?
Yes, no, I do think that all of those things could shift. Again, you know, with the caveat that I'm not a military analyst, right? If we remember, you know, last summer when we were settling in for a war of attrition, right? And then, all of a sudden, we see the tremendous breakthroughs that the Ukrainian military made in the northeast around Kharkiv. And the conversation certainly here in Washington around a war of attrition evaporated, right? Almost overnight, right? All of a sudden there was this question of actually, could there be a catastrophic collapse of Russian lines? Is Ukraine going to be able to push this forward? Ukraine was very careful and cautious, about how it managed that advance. And again, from all of the smart, analysts that I listened to, that seems to have been the right way to go about things. Right? We all of a sudden the conversation and the policy conversation around the war shifted, and then in a matter of weeks it shifted back, right, as it became clear that Russia was dug in certain positions, and the ability and willingness of Ukraine to push the advance and risk creating vulnerabilities for itself was limited, again, probably as it should have been. Meant that, in fact, things were going to slow down. They bogged down again over the winter, and now we're all wondering what's going to happen with, Russia's renewed offensive, which seems to be moving slowly, if at all, right? But everybody, should be aware of the fact that that can change. That then there will be a Ukrainian response to that. It strikes me again, and I say this entirely as a dilettante when it comes to things that involve, you know, guns and tanks and men fighting in trenches, that these processes are inherently contingent. They are inherently unpredictable in and of themselves, because they have a logic that, yes, you know, has something to do with all of the decisions that are being made here in offices in Washington and in Brussels and in Berlin and in Moscow and in Kiev, for that matter. But they also involve lots of variables that are simply very difficult to track and even to understand if you could track them. My point really is that if we keep sort of extrapolating our vision of the war, right, from the moment at which we find ourselves, right, then we will continually be surprised, and we will continually be behind the ball, and we will continually struggle to focus on strategy. We will let our strategies, whether it's in terms of how to deal with Russia or what kind of support to give to Ukraine, or frankly, how to talk about the war with our own populations ahead of our own elections, for example, in 2024 here in the U.S., that if we're constantly in that responsive, reactive mode, we're going to struggle to have a real strategy of our own.
Great point, including the part about upcoming elections here in the West. We're getting a little short on time, but I'd like to take a few questions from listeners, if there are any. So please, if you'd like to ask a question, you can hit the button in the Twitter space to request to speak. You can send a DM or post your question as a reply to the Twitter space. So I'll give it a few moments. If anyone wants to raise their hand, request to speak. I guess I don't see any questions for now. I'm going to, if you don't mind, Sam, I'll just ask a follow-up question.
Sure.
Thanks. Kind of related to the last point that you were making. And you wrote about Biden's words in your Substack, and how it's actually pretty unusual pushback that the West has given to the Soviet or Russian offensive, going back to Hungary and Czechoslovakia and Georgia and Ukraine in 2014. He said, we will support you for as long as it takes. I mean, do you think the numbers, I think, in terms of polls in the U.S. at least, I haven't looked much at ones in Europe, but you know, they do seem to, I mean, you get some pretty loud criticism in small parts of the, from small groups about how much aid there is or how much support, saying there should be less support for Ukraine. But it seems to me that polls are showing, you know, fairly strong support, and it doesn't seem to have been flagging yet. Is that what you would say, or do you have a different view of what's happening with that?
Well, it is different in different countries. I think in the U.S. we've seen, strong but gradually, softly declining support over time, increasing questions about the amount of money that's being spent. We do see a very clear partisan divide between Democrats and Republicans, although perhaps not as clear as we might expect to see, largely because the Republicans haven't themselves actually settled on a party line when it comes to Ukraine. And so that could actually, Republican support or lack thereof could go in either direction, I think, depending on how the party decides to approach this issue, particularly as we approach the primaries. We see similar things. We see partisan divides in Germany, to a certain extent in France, on this. We don't really see partisan divides in the UK, where, there really isn't any daylight between any of the major parties when it comes to support for Ukraine. But what I think concerns me is that the argument that has been used thus far to talk about the war, go back to President Biden's State of the Union speech, for example, the argument that's been used to talk about the war to Western publics has been predominantly a moral argument, right? That we are doing this because it's the right thing to do. We're standing up for a democratic state that's being bullied by an authoritarian state. We are standing up for values. We're standing up for what's right. And all of that is true and all of that is wonderful. But I'm not entirely convinced that it's enough. There are very good reasons why Western countries have an interest in making sure that Russia does not win this war and that Ukraine does win this war in clear and incontrovertible terms, right? Put briefly, right, we will not want to live in the world that emerges if Russia is allowed to win this war. And when you talk to people on Capitol Hill, in the administration, in governments around Europe, all of the policymakers understand that, right? They understand the consequences for global peace, security, and prosperity if Russia does win this war. I wish they would have that conversation with their own publics so that people, including Republicans in this country or some people in Germany, for example, who are, you know, concerned about whether it's morally the right thing for Germany to be getting involved in a war on the European continent, so that people understand the policy consequences, not just the moral consequences of allowing this war to go in Russia's direction, and that to me is sort of the missing leg of the Western response, at least, you know, politically. It would also help, I think, deal with some of the reasons why support for this war, you know, has flagged and will flag, which is that people, frankly, are concerned about, you know, their own livelihoods. People are facing cost of living crises in various countries around the West. We have significant structural issues and imbalances and inequalities to deal with in our own societies and economies. And we have somehow sort of allowed ourselves to believe that we can, separate the foreign policy aspects of this war, right, from what's happening internally. From a voter's perspective, it doesn't work that way, right? They have to, live in this world, in both parts of this world, at the same time, and it comes home to people in very material ways. And if we don't recognize that, if we don't acknowledge that, don't support that, and help societies and economies, bear the costs that this war is imposing on us and will continue to impose on us, then, you know, even if we don't undermine support for the war itself, we will undermine support for the governments that have been committed to this war. And that instability, again, will redound to Putin's favor. Right? So I do wish that we would, and our politicians would, learn to talk about this war in new ways.
That's thanks very much, Sam. Thanks for that answer. We do have a question which I'll read from Matt, M-A-T. The question is, why would Ukraine ever agree to stop fighting when Medvedev said last week that Russia would be prepared to go to the Polish border? If Ukraine stops fighting, then they may face a mass genocide. That's clear from the way Russia has acted so far in occupied areas.
It's a good question, an important question. It's a good question even without paying attention to Medvedev, who, frankly, I don't think is worth paying a lot of attention to. Right? He's much more of a media personality, frankly, than a politician, even if he holds theoretically important office. But I think, the question is a clear one, right? I think if I were a Ukrainian citizen, which, to be very clear, I'm not, right? But if I were a Ukrainian citizen, I would feel very similarly to the way that Matt has posed the question. Ukraine can and should, right, be fighting for everything that is Ukraine's and is owed to it, and should be very, very concerned about the possible consequences of of ceasing to fight. My only point in saying that that can shift, right, is that, you know, look, history does know circumstances in which that has shifted. And again, that is, you know, the sovereign and democratic right of Ukrainian citizens. The point is that we shouldn't expect Zelensky's position on how much to fight for, right, to shift until and unless Ukrainian public opinion shifts. And it would be, you know, the corollary of that is it would be a tremendous mistake for Western politicians to try to shift Zelensky's position ahead of wherever the Ukrainian public is, right? All that will do is undermine Zelensky's position vis-a-vis his public. It will create political instability in Ukraine, and it will communicate to Ukrainian citizens themselves that the West is no longer on their side. And once again, that's not going to create a world in which we want to live. So it's, again, the point here is that Zelensky, you know, draws his power, he draws his position, and he draws his policies from the Ukrainian population and not the other way around.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we see that sort of that idea kind of tested very often. You know, you see kind of pushes, not from the governments, but from, you know, from people, some people in the West, kind of pushing for certain, you know, for ceasefire talks without really talking about, you know, the conditions, that sort of thing. So you kind of get a lot of that. And in fact, in connection with Medvedev, who I agree, you know, is what he says is basically just part of the propaganda. But I guess he came out with, you know, said, oh, Ukraine is considering, you know, a split, you know, give Russia the Donbass and other parts. And of course, Ukraine came back and said, you know, no, this is not happening. But this is just one example of how these kind of ideas get out there of and there's a risk that people in the West may push, may try to push Zelensky and the Ukrainian government in directions that Ukrainians are not ready to go in at all. Okay. I'll call on another questioner, Martin. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Steve. And I fully agree with what the professor was saying before. I'll just, if I may, Steve, if that's okay, Martin calling from Canada. I think some observations. To me, in conversation with a wiser friend, the great export of Russia right now is shame. And I think we in the West, and I hope you don't mind me using the collective we, of course, we in the democratic West have to keep reinforcing that in the media as well, that what this character, I call him Putler, as others have, in Russia has done is brought great shame upon the Russian nation. And I think that's incumbent, in my opinion, at least, to show that what he's done with this war of genocidal aggression against Ukraine, this unprovoked war, and, you know, the kidnapping of all of these children into Russia from Ukraine, and of course the death and destruction that he has brought to Ukraine itself. We really, I think, have to keep reinforcing that so that, you know, the message is continuous and we don't forget that really, and I hope I'm not overstating it, but I'll say it because I believe this fervently, is that this war that Ukraine is fighting, Steve and everyone else, is and which the West is supporting by and large, is not only for the independence, sovereignty, and maintenance of democracy in Ukraine, but it is for us as well. I don't think we can really overstate that point. So I just wanted to bring that to the attention of you and everyone else that 1 year into this conflict, I am as committed as ever to support what I feel is a just cause against naked, unprovoked aggression. And that's really, really crucial. And let me just conclude again, and I'm sorry for blabbing, and thank you for letting me pontificate like this, Steve. I think that we have a real responsibility, I believe this very much, that we have to point these factors out. And by the way, there's a post on Twitter today by the Minister of Foreign Affairs of Lithuania. And I encourage people who are listening to this this week ahead in Russia from Radio Free Europe to look at it. And he gives all the reasons why Ukraine must win and can win in total. Okay, so that's enough for me. And thank you for listening. And I'll drop down to listener. And perhaps you, Steve, and Professor, you could comment.
Thanks, Martin. I'll just speak briefly on that. I mean, that was part of why I was mentioning what Sam wrote in the start of his Substack. I don't have it in front of me, but it served as a reminder of, you know, yet this is this is a horrible war of aggression. It's happening every hour, every day, and that's something that, you know, Putin is obviously trying to make people in Russia not pay attention to and forget and get used to. And it's something that we can't get used to and shouldn't. So thanks for your comment. I don't know if Sam wants to add anything.
I would agree really with everything that was said. And there was a lot in there. I'm not sure there was a question, but I mean, yes, and I think, Steve, coming back to, you know, to what you were just saying, as analysts, we don't use the word a lot, but empathy is a really important analytical skill, I think, and being able to, it's something that's very difficult to do, and certainly difficult to do all the time, right? But every once in a while, you know, picking yourself up out of your own shoes and putting yourself in the shoes of people in Ukraine facing this war. Really does bring a lot of clarity. I think, you know, the other thing that Martin mentioned, right, is if I'm interpreting this correctly, and I think it's absolutely true, right, is that in a very real sense, right, this is also a war that Putin is perpetrating in and against his own country. And it comes back, Steve, to a lot of the things we were talking about earlier. Obviously, there are a lot of Russians who support this war for one reason or another. And I don't want to justify that in any sense. And certainly what Russians of any stripe are facing, pales in comparison to what Ukrainians are facing. But, you know, looking ahead to 2024, and Putin's impending re-election and anything else in Russian politics, the reality is that Putin has decided and found really that this war cements and solidifies his position. I don't know whether that's why he went into it in the first place. I'm not going to try to psychoanalyze his decision making. But the reality at the moment, right, is it justifies everything that he is doing in Russian politics and empowers him in ways that really he has never enjoyed before. Whether you are, primarily concerned or even only concerned about what happens in Ukraine, or whether you think, as I tend to, that, once Russia has lost in Ukraine, that lasting peace and security and prosperity in Europe was going to require change in Russia itself. The only way either of those things are achieved is through, again, a complete and incontrovertible defeat of everything that Putin is trying to achieve, whether that's in Ukraine or in Russia itself.
Okay, thanks very much, Sam. A question from, I think this will be the question from CC Ryder. You can go ahead.
I'm glad I heard the little chuckle. I'm glad you appreciate it. My name. So I'm a fan of Radio Free Europe and journalism in general. Come from a family of journalists. But I just wanted to say that we should be really careful because words matter. And so, for example, the title of the space, War Without End, is actually a Russian talking point. And so with this, you know, Putin just said, I mean, the definition of genocide, right? We'll do this till we kill you forever if it takes. So, you know, it's kind of like George Lakoff, the political strategist. If any of you have ever read him, he has a book called Don't Think of an Elephant. So, like, in the 80s, in my country, the Republicans came up with the term tax relief, and then even the Democrats were using the term tax relief. So I would just say that I love you guys. I support journalism. I'm not one of those media critics, but I do take issue with the title, War Without End, because there's just a little sensationalist flavor to it that, you know, for people that are stopping by and don't, especially that don't know a lot, they just take those sound bites like that. I see where you guys meant to go with it, but I just think it's a little misplaced because people take that and run with it, and it is just an out-and-out Russian talking point. Thanks.
All right, thank you. Yeah, I'll just say, I mean, I appreciate your point very much so. And we're actually very careful. I try to be very careful to not kind of repeat or somehow amplify Russian Kremlin Putin talking points. You know, it's become such a huge issue now because, you know, for years, media organizations were reporting a lot of things that Putin or Lavrov or anyone would say. And, you know, now and in recent years, doing that without context, without sometimes a lot of context, you know, really risks repeating or amplifying Kremlin propaganda. So I appreciate your point. I mean, as you probably discerned, the idea was to ask the question, you know, is this as Putin was seeming to characterize it in his speech, you know, is it a war without end, a war that's open-ended? But I take your point, and thanks for your close attention to what we're doing. Appreciate it. And on that note, I think we are out of time, so I'm just going to I'll wrap it up here. Thanks very much for your questions and comments. Sam, thanks very much for joining me.
Thank you.
All right. So once again, I've been speaking to Sam Green, a professor at the Russia Institute at King's College London, Director of Democratic Resilience at the Center for European Policy Analysis, and co-author of the book Putin versus the People. My name is Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL. As I mentioned at the start, this conversation will also be published as a podcast, and you can subscribe to The Week Ahead in Russia and other RFERL podcasts on Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you listen to podcasts. I'll be away next Monday, but The Week Ahead in Russia will go ahead as usual with a guest host, so please tune in. And please keep an eye out on Fridays for my newsletter, The Week in Russia. Thanks for listening.